This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. As I speak on Friday, Saudi TV is reporting that on October 2nd, journalist Jamal Khashoggi bled to death after a fist fight inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Turkish officials say he was murdered and dismembered there by a team sent for that purpose. Earlier this week, President Trump suggested rogue killers may be to blame. But at every turn, the Saudi crown prince has been implicated.
One of the suspects who entered with the suspected hit squad 2 weeks ago is Maher Mutreb, a former bodyguard of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and a diplomat who is often seen traveling alongside the royal.
The New York Times is reporting that one of the suspects was a frequent companion of the crown prince. Three others linked to his security detail. And of course, there's the forensic doctor reportedly carrying a bone saw.
The real head scratcher remains. Why is Donald Trump doing Saudi Arabia's public relations work for them? And do his comments about rogue killers match the information he's been given from his own intelligence agencies?
Another head scratcher is why, for so long, the American press seemed to be doing the Saudi royals' PR work too.
32-year-old Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince better known as MBS, arresting many of his own cousins in a sweeping crackdown on corruption.
Regarded as one of the most conservative countries in the world, Saudi Arabia is an authoritarian, absolute monarchy where women's rights are extremely limited. But under MBS, things are changing rapidly.
He is emancipating women, introducing music and cinema, and cracking down on corruption.
In effect, he's leading a revolution from above.
It's a fawning characterization that Jamal Khashoggi disputed in an interview with NPR earlier this year.
He has no interest in political reform. He thinks he can do it alone. And he doesn't want really any counter-opinion or anyone to share those changes in Saudi Arabia with him.
As New York Times media columnist Jim Rutenberg noted, the MBS moniker has taken on a grim new meaning for what he refers to as the plugged-in set of Washington. MBS is now Mr. Bonesaw. A new perspective for the Washington set, perhaps, but not for those who have been paying closer attention. Georgetown professor Abdullah Al-Aryan last year assembled a timeline of 70 years of the New York Times describing Saudi royals as reformers. Abdullah, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start in 53. The headline you chose was, "New King Plans to Use Nation's Oil Income to Finance Social and Economic Measures." That headline could have been written last year. I'm thinking of Thomas Friedman's piece in November titled, "Saudi Arabia's Arab Spring. At last, the Crown Prince has big plans for his society."
Yeah, that's really the hitch with this narrative, is the fact that it's constantly on the brink of being that kind of enlightened, reformed, progressive society. You know, regardless of which king, which monarch happens to be in power at the time, they're always just aspiring towards something, but just never quite seems to get there.
Which reminds me of the headline in 1960, "King Saud has increasingly assumed the role of liberal champion of constitutional reform." And you note that the Saudi constitution wouldn't be adopted for another 32 years in 1992.
Right. And even then, the constitution was only adopted by royal decree and not actually as part of any sort of political opening that was inclusive of the rest of society.
What do you think drives that kind of anticipation?
These narratives tend to be constructed as part of a process by which the United States is attempting to justify its policies in the region, attempting to justify its alliances on the basis purely of preserving its own interests.
But then again, we also have dismemberments and beheadings and the oppression of women and so on, as we see it in the West. And the government has to negotiate that thorny territory. But it seems like the media has been a willing partner in that.
You know, we have a kind of binary approach to viewing Saudi Arabia. I do think that it tends to be problematic, not just on the one side in which, of course, they're presented constantly as reformers, but then there's also the sort of very stereotypical views as these barbaric civilizations and the kind of orientalist lens through which the Middle East is often viewed lends itself to a kind of a carrot and stick approach. So on the one hand, you paint them in a very kind of villainous role, and then you give them the opportunity to reform and to become enlightened. And the best example of that, I would say, is really looking just at this last year with the Saudi crown prince. This new generation of Saudi elites has internalized these narratives over the course of many decades and actually come to play into them by essentially trying to placate certain liberal sensibilities, things like granting women the right to drive or reopening movie theaters, knowing that these kinds of things could be used as cover for things like a massive consolidation of power and a massively reckless and violent foreign policy that, of course, has seen its brutality taken out on the people of Yemen. This is sort of par for the course in terms of the way that everyone bought into the first line while kind of ignoring the second.
Thomas Friedman in the New York Times called Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman more McKinsey than Wahhabi.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's one of those classic lines that really jumps out. There's a specific kind of way in which we conceive of how the crown prince has kind of allied himself with particular policy elites and consulting elites and the ways in which he tailor-made this message. And I think you saw that a lot on the tour that he just took within the U.S. just over the last few months.
The crown prince of Saudi Arabia stopped traffic and turned heads on his trip to Seattle to talk with Silicon Valley's biggest hitters.
Media executives Rupert Murdoch, Bob Iger, and Oprah, too. This as Saudi Arabia dramatically opens up to foreign entertainment in the kingdom, going from zero to big bucks.
Let's talk about their PR effort. They're really good at this, aren't they?
I mean, one of the things that really struck me is in every single interview that MBS did, including, I believe, his 60 Minutes interview, I mean, he really had this honed line about Saudi extremism and support for sort of the most militant kind of Wahhabi ideologies that somehow pointed the finger back at Iran and this idea that 1979 signaled this turning point.
After 1979, we were victims, especially my generation, that suffered from this a great deal.
And he said it in every single interview that he did, and it was echoed by every single journalist who covered him while he was in the country. And as a result, he can be this white knight riding in and cleansing Saudi society of its extremist tendencies, while at the same time, he's actually engaged in far more war crimes than probably the several Saudi kings going back generations. The Khashoggi case, in a lot of ways, is the sort of exception that proves the rule in the ways that there has been, I would say, a very laudable reaction on the part of the U.S. media, in particular, the newspapers that have been the most heavily implicated in that kind of gleaming coverage of Saudi Arabia going back many years.
You think there's been a move towards mea culpa?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I think that this case in particular hit a little close to home because Khashoggi represented someone who had sort of endeared himself, I think, to that same kind of elite, that he made a lot of friends in Washington, that he, of course, was himself a columnist for the Washington Post. And so as a result, I think we see this outrage that we don't normally see on the part of the press, especially when it comes to the fact that these kind of incidents have been occurring with some regularity. Anybody who was either part of a social movement, religious preachers, feminist movements, student youth groups, anybody who had anything to say online on social media was basically rounded up. Sometimes people who didn't really say anything at all, because just for their lack of explicit support for the regime, that was enough to see them hauled off to prison.
Did you see Rula Khalif's recent article in the Financial Times?
Yeah.
She was talking about how Western journalists love to see every new leader in the region as a reformer first, before proven otherwise. What do you think about that pattern?
Well, I mean, I think that speaking about them as reformers is really just code for will they be reliable allies who will protect and preserve kind of U.S. interests in the region. And that's really the only measure. But if you live up to these kind of expectations, you can expect to be showered with more praise, with more promises of aid and support and, you know, glowing media coverage. The article mentions a lot of examples, including Assad, Gaddafi, and others.
Members of Congress of both parties have said they believe he's a reformer.
Muammar Gaddafi's second son was once regarded as the man who would bring Libya closer to the West.
I mean, one that comes to mind is Saddam Hussein. That's not mentioned. And I think it's interesting to see how his transformation occurred as someone who was a modernizer, someone who was seen as a reliable ally, specifically during the 8-year war with Iran in the 1980s. And then, of course, the moment that he breaks with the U.S. and decides to launch his own aggressive foreign policy, specifically with his invasion of Kuwait in 1990, all of a sudden he becomes this sort of brutal dictator. All of a sudden people were paying attention to human rights abuses as though they didn't exist in the 1980s.
Does MBS no longer get a pass?
If the narrative begins to shift again and all of a sudden, you know, somehow this all gets swept under the rug and there's the opportunity to reinvent himself yet again as this reformer, perhaps even a repentant reformer in this case, then I think that at that point, yeah, we will have failed. But if there is going to be a kind of a continued critical engagement to the point where it's going to be really difficult for him to ever be able to sort of entertain the same kinds of, you know, business elites coming to visit or policymakers or getting the kind of glossy coverage that he's received up to this point, that may signal a massive shift.
And will you be watching the New York Times or Thomas Friedman's column?
Yeah, well, that's a really easy target, I think, just given sort of how brazen it's been. But I think that this is a phenomenon that exists beyond. It's a much wider problem, obviously, and we see it across news networks and we see it across other papers and we see it even outside of the United States in the European context as well.
Abdullah, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Abdullah Al-Aryan is an associate professor of Middle East history at Georgetown University in Qatar and author of Answering the Call, Popular Islamic Activism in Sadat's Egypt. On Friday, The Washington Post reported that conservative outlets and Republicans have not so quietly started a smear campaign against Jamal Khashoggi to, quote, support Trump's continued aversion to a forceful response to the oil-rich desert kingdom. The Post pointed to Republican Senate candidate from Virginia, Corey Stewart, telling a local radio program that the murdered journalist, quote, was not a good guy himself, and commentators highlighting his association with terrorists. Before being known as a liberal analyst, Khashoggi once did support Islamic movements, and he interviewed a young Osama bin Laden as a journalist. But none of this factored into the narrative being shared among Trump supporters. This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Over the past decade, Elizabeth Warren has become a progressive icon.
Perhaps the most powerful elected voice among the progressives right now.
I'd love Elizabeth Warren to be vice president. I'd love her to be anything. I'd love her to be a female Ghostbuster.
But the senator has struggled with a personal issue since she first ran for office in 2012.
Ms. Warren, I want to start with questions about your Native American heritage. You've acknowledged that you listed yourself as a minority in a faculty directory in 1986. You continued to list yourself in those directories until 1995. Do you consider yourself a minority? And if not...
I have answered this question many, many times. And it starts with the fact that from the day I was born until the day my mother died, she told me about who I am, who we are, who my brothers are, who my family is.
Just a ticking of a box, personal family lore, a small set of data points, and yet ones on which Warren's opponents, most notably President Trump, pounced.
She said because her cheekbones were high, she was an Indian, that she was Native American.
In July, he escalated.
I will give you $1 million to your favorite charity, paid for by Trump, if you take the test and it shows you're an Indian.
This week, Warren responded by way of a 5.5-minute pre-campaign video. In it, she speaks with Carlos Bustamante, a Stanford genetics professor who examined her DNA.
In the senator's genome, we did find 5 segments of Native American ancestry with very high confidence.
The facts suggest that you
absolutely have a Native American ancestor in your pedigree.
The response was probably not what Warren had anticipated.
She came out and thought she scored it first.
Yes.
And so did the media. And they started demanding Donald Trump pay off the $1 million bet. And then all of a sudden, now she's at war with the Cherokee Nation. And
saying that her use of the DNA test is inappropriate and, quote, undermining tribal interests.
From both the right and the left, opprobrium. Accusations that she's not Native enough, that she's reinforcing biological essentialism, that she's falling for a Trump trap before the midterms, that she's trying to claim Native identity without ever defending Native issues, that she allowed a university to use her to bolster its diversity bona fides. A political miscalculation, but also a stumble into controversies that extend far beyond politics.
There's a running joke in Indian country where people say, oh yeah, some other person told me that they have a Cherokee great-grandmother or a Cherokee princess in their lineage. And so when we're out in the world and we meet people and they say, oh, you're Native? Oh, my great-grandmother was Cherokee. Our first response is to try not to roll our eyes.
Kim Tallbear is a professor of Native Studies at the University of Alberta and author of Native American DNA, Tribal Belonging and the False Promise of Genetic Science.
This story for us has a much longer timeline than I think many Americans understand. Elizabeth Warren's appropriation of Native identity, despite her disclaimers, I don't mean to sound cliche, but everything that's taken from Indigenous people, be it actual land and resources, or be it, you know, an image that can be marketed and used for a football team, or taking claims to ancestry and making those part of the identity that one is espousing to the world. Our understandings of kinship and family and tribe are not governed so strongly by the idea of having distant, unnamed ancestry. We have a much stronger sense of what it is to be Native American that is governed by our family relationships, by lived social relations. That matters to us.
We know in the 50s, Watson and Crick discovered the double helix structure of DNA. And ever since, talk of blood as lineage and fate have given way to conversations about mitochondrial DNA and all the rest. At the same time, there are old metaphors that persist. You can still be related either by blood or by marriage. So talk about how the contrast between scientific jargon and traditional blood talk plays out in Native culture.
I caution people against equating blood with genes. These are pretty different ideas. When you are looking at tribal citizenship rules, even if they talk about something like blood quantum, these are fractions on paper that point to very particular ancestors. The Dawes Allotment Act at the turn of the 20th century distributed 160-acre parcels of land to heads of household, and of course only men. In settler ideas of family at the time, could be heads of household. They would get another 80 acres if they had a wife. Women become economically tied to men. That's not how it was in many Indigenous communities. Women were not economically tied to men. And then the man gets another 40 acres for each child. But in order to manage those land allotments, you had to have a register of Indians. Well, tribes and First Nations and other Indigenous communities didn't necessarily have lists with names of their people and their kin. These are fluid kinship groups, right? But now we live with the legacy of those registers, and that's how tribal enrollment is governed. Mm. What we care about is proving that you are descended from somebody on the base roll that was constructed during that time.
And by the base roll, you're talking about families that were listed at the end of the 1800s.
Yeah. When you see on the back of my tribal enrollment card that I'm 1/32nd this, 1/16th this, 1/4 of this tribe, those are all particular ancestors that they're pointing to. That 1/4 Cheyenne Arapaho blood, quote unquote, is my grandfather, Randy Tallbear. It's not as if blood, the physiological substance, is being examined. We're really talking about symbolic blood, and we're pointing to named people. And so this is the problem with Elizabeth Warren taking a DNA test that's pointing to some distant, probable, unnamed ancestor that nobody knows who they were affiliated with or who they were. For us, it's who's your mom? Who's your grandma? Who's your great-grandfather? Who are your cousins? Who are your aunties and uncles?
You say your daughter doesn't get to be a citizen of the tribe because of these blood quantum rules.
So in my tribe, the Sistan-Wapton Oyate, they will enroll you if you are descended from somebody on the base roll. But in my tribe, in addition, they have a requirement that you must meet a total 1/4 Indian blood quotient. They will accept the blood, there's always scare quotes around that word, from multiple tribes. So even though I don't have 1/4, quote unquote, Dakota blood, I have Cheyenne and Arapaho blood. That's where you begin to see the racial inflection, I think. So my daughter, if you were to calculate all her ancestors, because I'm supposedly 1/32nd Native American, my daughter would be 1/2 of that because her father's non-Native. Now, if my tribe decides to move to a 1/8 total Indian blood rule instead of 1/4, my daughter and her couple of cousins who can't get enrolled will be able to get enrolled. Mm-hmm. And we debate this every year. We've got, you know, debates and conversations on our reservation. Should we go from 1/4 total Indian blood down to 1/8? And I think eventually we will. You do see tribes across the country moving away from a blood quantum standards more towards lineal descent rules to try to make our rules more inclusive. But that's up to us to debate. We don't need the rest of Americans telling us what we should do and how colonized we are by race. Everybody's colonized by race. Tribal governments and tribal communities are doing the best we can to try to tweak those rules to include our traditional notions of kinship. But within a structure that has been deeply shaped by colonial power, we're at a severe power imbalance with the U.S. federal government.
Do you think that Warren was basically played by Trump, drawn into this? Because it doesn't seem that she got any kind of educational or financial advantage by her association with the Cherokee, and it may have been part of her family lore. Do you think that she just got played into a discussion of race and blood and women, and this is something Masha Gessen said in The New Yorker, you know, all the things that Trump loves to talk about in order to defend herself against his taunt?
You know, I don't think he has the intellectual ability to play somebody who is as intelligent as Elizabeth Warren. Mm-hmm. I mean, really. She has for her entire life, like many people in Oklahoma, in the South and in the East of the U.S., lived with this myth of an Indian in her family tree. And that's really important to those people. She's probably really invested in defending her family's story. I've seen people break down crying when they find out that they don't have a Native American ancestor. This is a cherished idea for a lot of non-Native Americans.
But you're saying it's really irrelevant even if they did.
Right. But for non-Native people who have a settler colonial idea of kinship and ancestry and family, finding that genetic proof is important to them.
Why do you think they do it?
I think they're very much influenced by that one drop rule that is so prominent in racial discourse in the United States. I have one drop back there somewhere, therefore I can make a claim. That is very racialized thinking. And again, Native people in the U.S. are not completely exempt from that. We struggle with that because it's imposed on us. But we also have this much more powerful way of identifying that's about kinship and tribe and citizenship that helps us mitigate some of the desire to invoke race in that way. But for non-Native people, that's all they got.
So what was your reaction to the controversy over Warren's video presentation of her link to the Cherokees?
when I finally sat down and watched that video the other night, literally, I started to feel nauseous, and I felt slightly grief-stricken for a moment. And it's not often that that feeling of grief comes up for me, because I've lived my whole life with the kind of Indigenous erasure that we have in the U.S. But that video really brought to light the deeply held ideas in the U.S. popular imagination about how everybody can claim to be Native, to have an ancestor in the family, without actually having lived relations with Native people. It just, I don't know, something in that video crystallized for me the deep power imbalance that exists between Indigenous people and everybody else. Our voices just don't matter. Our definitions of who we are just don't matter, because our images are so much more important to non-Native people as they romanticize this American past. So who we are as people in and of ourselves is not important. We are only tokens that help most Americans feel comfortable in a land that's been stolen. I don't know how to put it more specifically than that.
Rebecca Nagel wrote last year in Think Progress, she said that as contemporary Native Americans, the Trumps and Warrens of the world leave very little space for us to exist, which, when you understand the history of the United States, makes perfect sense.
Yes, Rebecca Nagel put it perfectly. Yes, I agree.
Dr. Tallbear, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on.
Dr. Kim Tallbear is a professor of Native Studies at the University of Alberta. DNA tests will never confirm membership in the Native American community, but African Americans have a use for such biological markers. Indeed, for many Black people, DNA testing is just the latest chapter in a long-standing search for origins that took off during the Black Power era and was exemplified by the 1977 TV miniseries Roots.
Tonight, we present a landmark in television entertainment. Roots, the true story Alex Haley uncovered in his 12 years search across the seven generations of his ancestry.
Sociologist Alondra Nelson says that for the many African Americans that have been stripped of their ancestral languages, their culture, and knowledge of their roots, DNA tests, while imperfect, can be a solace and a guide.
If you know nothing at all, the ability to even be able to get a genetic inference is filling in a lot of information. You know, for example, one of the groups that I encounter are a group of people who call themselves DNA Sierra Leoneans. And for them to be able to have a religious ceremony that they call a SARA, a ceremony of remembrance about their ancestors who were trafficked and lost during the slave trade, is a kind of reconciliation, even as there's an appreciation that the technology doesn't fully fill in all of the gaps.
And you trace the origins of DNA testing for reconciliation purposes back to Argentina, after the government disappeared thousands of people during the dirty war in the 70s and the 80s, when they took the children of people who were disappeared and placed them with other families, DNA was used to prove blood relationships.
A very young medical geneticist, Mary Claire King, who would become quite renowned for her research on the BRCA breast cancer gene, goes to work with these grandmothers in Argentina. The use of it by African Americans that I trace, that begins with the advent of the direct-to-consumer ancestry testing industry in the United States, which emerges in the early aughts, is preceded by a couple of decades of other uses of genetics to answer questions about the past.
Among them at the African burial ground in Lower Manhattan back in the 90s.
Yes. Here you have an African-American geneticist named Rick Kittles and a businesswoman named Jana Page starting this company in 2003 that's based on scientific research that Rick Kittles does as a member of the African burial ground research project.
And what were they looking for?
There was an attempt to put up a federal building, and it turned out that it was, in fact, a burial ground. And so what starts as a construction site becomes, soon after, an excavation site. At the time, the largest known burial ground that offers us any information about enslaved Africans from colonial era New York. Rick Kittles, who hadn't even finished his PhD in genetics, could use these new genetic techniques to make some inferences about where on the African continent these buried folks might have hailed from. That process and that question comes to animate the African Ancestry Company that he starts in 2003.
The African Ancestry Company, is that kind of like 23andMe?
It is like 23andMe, although it precedes 23andMe by about 5 years.
Oh.
So one of the first pioneering companies was a Black-owned genetic ancestry testing company that's still in business today.
I did not know that one of the first significant companies to do this was designed to help African Americans discover what their actual roots were.
And designed by people who were very well-versed in the history of scientific racism, who could say, we understand the limits of the technology, we understand what the history of eugenics and genetics has meant in the world, but we are trying to use it in a way that we hope can offer some new information to communities that would otherwise not have it.
One of the points that's most important to you is that it adds complexity to a kind of flattened notion of race. Slavery was a caste system, and nobody seemed to care where they came from, what their cultural background was, and this returns that information to people.
Genetic ancestry testing becomes a place to turn to offer those possibilities for new ways of thinking about oneself. But it's in the context of technologies that are making kind of inferences and are using, certainly in the early days of the market, a few genetic markers and saying that these few genetic markers are Poland or are Igbo or are Mauritania. And that's a kind of reduction of all of who humans are to a few markers, even as the sort of intention here is to give fullness in humanity. The cost of doing that is to imbue very abstract and technical things with a sense of culture and place.
You chronicled the story of, and I'm going to mess this up, Deidre
Farmer Palemon.
Right. She was an activist who organized a class action suit by descendants of slaves in 2002, but she couldn't prove standing. There was no way that she could show that she was a direct descendant of the people whose enslavement these companies profited from.
She goes to the African Ancestry Company in 2004, so the market's about 2.5 years old in the United States, and purchases genetic ancestry tests and offers them as a sort of response to the critique that they didn't meet the standing doctrine. But these are technologies that come out of human population genetics, and so they're not technologies that can really go to the level of the individual.
Why not? I mean, don't we use blood tests to prove paternity?
So if we go back to the Argentina case, you had a close relative, a grandparent, grandmother, mm-hmm. grandfather, to whom one could compare oneself.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, given the long legacy of slavery and our inability to do some of the reconciliation that many are still seeking, many generations have passed.
Mm-hmm.
Identity is fundamentally a cultural issue, a political issue, a social issue. The reaction to Elizabeth Warren's announcement that she has Native American ancestry, I think, is a perfect example of this, right? Identity is something that we say about ourselves, but it's also something that others say about us. You know, certainly for African Americans, even though there's very much a historical and understandable desire to be able to lay claim to identities that are not just about race as caste,
mm-hmm.
it's also the case that particularly at a place like the United States in 2018 that's deeply polarized and becoming deeply racialized, no one is making fine distinctions in the workplace, in the housing market between forms of African ethnicity or whether or not someone is deemed to be just black or white and what those racial identities, spurious as they are, entitle people to or don't entitle people to in the world.
Alondra, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to speak with you, Brooke.
Alondra Nelson is president of the Social Science Research Council, professor of sociology at Columbia University, and author of The Social Life of DNA, Race, Reparations, and Reconciliation After the Genome. Coming up, another application of genetic research and another kind of controversy. Twins! This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The double helix structure of deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA, was discovered just 65 years ago. But mankind has been playing with the notion of what makes us who we are for millennia. Twins, especially, played a prominent role in ancient mythologies. The founders of Rome, Remus and Romulus, twin brothers raised by a giant wolf. Castor and Pollux, half-twin brothers whose Gemini forms sparkle in the night sky. The birth of twins has been interpreted as good luck and as bad, and they themselves as two halves of the lightness and darkness of our nature. That's never stopped. You see it in sci-fi sagas like Star Trek.
Now, Data's evil twin plots to destroy the crew.
Back off. Go!
With the help of a lethal life force on Star Trek The Next Generation.
A Southern California woman who was dubbed the evil twin and convicted of plotting to kill her twin sister could be granted parole.
As vehicles for conflict, serendipity, and comedies of error.
They're cousins, identical cousins.
So if your mom is my mom, and my dad is your dad, and we're both born on October 11th, then you and I are like sisters. Sisters. Hallie. We're like twins.
Double trouble, what twin partners in crime are accused of doing.
But beyond mere novelty, multiple births can provide scientists deep insights into the age-old argument between nature and nurture. A documentary released this summer, Three Identical Strangers, tells the story of triplets David, Eddie, and Bobby, adopted by three different families and studied under highly unusual circumstances. Spoilers ahead.
They separated these boys at birth.
The parents had never been told that there were two other children.
What was the purpose?
Why? How could you not tell us?
They're trying to conceal what they did from the people they did it to.
When you play with humans, you do something very wrong.
Who would be evil enough to come up with something like this?
The secret study, orchestrated by psychologist Peter Neubauer, sought to examine how three distinct parenting styles might shape identical triplets reared apart. Not until the boys met by chance at age 19 did they learn how their lives had been manipulated for a trove of data that remains largely locked away in an archive at Yale. According to Dr. Nancy Siegel, the director of the Twin Studies Center at California State University at Fullerton, the unreleased study was likely inconclusive and definitely cruel.
Well, I think this was a very unethical study. Keep in mind that even though in those times the practice was that you don't encourage contact, but nevertheless, these children were never told they were twins, and most of these adoptive parents who were hungry for children would have gladly taken two. So to not tell people this very important aspect of their background, I think is just horrendous. It's really beyond my comprehension. And
why?
I know that... because being a twin is a very important part of one's identity, one's knowledge of one's medical history. And I can tell you that having worked with hundreds of pairs of twins raised apart, just how happy they are to have met and how regretful they are that they lost all those years together.
Twin studies often capture the public imagination, but none quite like NASA's twin study, which tracked the genetic profiles of two astronaut brothers, one who spent a year in space while his twin lived on Earth. The media had a field day with this.
Scott Kelly and Mark Kelly are the only identical twin astronauts in history, but following a DNA-altering space mission, they may not be identical anymore.
A year in space has already made Scott 2 inches taller than his brother.
Study found 7% of Scott's genes did not return to normal after he returned to Earth 2 years ago.
So they're no longer identical twins?
The space travel altered genetic expression. It did not alter the DNA physically itself. When he returned to Earth, the vast majority of his genetic material returned to the way it was initially. See, this is a fascinating finding because why identical twins differ in the expression of some traits, that's what we need to find out. I think it'll fascinate your listeners to know that if you take diseases like schizophrenia or multiple sclerosis or diabetes, you'd expect that the correlation should be about one if they have the same genes, but it's closer to 40-50%. Something has to trigger the expression in one and keep it quiet in the other. And identical twins reared apart or identical twins who differ in some way can help us find these environmental effects that might help us control and manage disease.
You've profiled other twins that have been shaped by extreme events. Could you tell us about the subjects of your book, Accidental Brothers?
Accidental Brothers follows the life histories of two sets of identical male twins who were born a day apart in Colombia, South America, in 1988. One pair of identical twins was born in Bogota, the capital city, and the other born in a small, remote town 150 miles to the north. But one of the little babies up in the north needed immediate care at a good hospital. So his grandmother brought him down to Bogota at the same hospital as the other twins were born. And somehow, in an amazing twist of fate, got exchanged with one of the other twins. So the wrong baby was brought back to the small town a week later. So they were essentially raised as two sets of fraternal twins when in fact they were unrelated. And they didn't know this until they were 25 when the brothers up north moved to Bogota and somebody confused a twin in one pair for a twin in the other. I went to Bogota 2 times to study them, and they are wonderful guys. And there were similarities in many personality traits between the real identical twins, despite their separate rearing. But you could see that the effects of the different environments had a role. The twins in the city had gone to high schools and good colleges. The twins up north didn't go past 5th grade. But I have to say that living with them, you could see the similarities really popping out. And the medical life histories were amazing. The one twin born in the city and raised in the city was basically symptom-free, as was his identical twin brother raised in the north. The other twin, who was raised in the city, who was not born there, had a long list of medical complaints, as did his twin brother up in the north. So even the different environments and the different access to medical care did not make a difference in their medical histories and physical health, which I find quite extraordinary.
So what did this tell you about nature versus nurture? It was too small a sample, I know, but...
Yes, but it's a very dramatic case. And so it told me a couple of things. In terms of the abilities, one could certainly see that not having access to education left an indelible stamp on those twins. But I will say that one of the twins who was raised in the small town who should have been raised in Bogota went and got himself a GED, a high school diploma, and is now finishing law school. So he always had the drive. He didn't have the opportunity. But I have also become very appreciative of extreme environments and how they influence behavior. I think that this is a very telling case in so many ways.
So what are some of the myths that you are confronted with on a regular basis that you would like to dispel right now?
One of them is that twins communicate telepathically. I have carefully reviewed the literature on that and published it in my book, Twin Myth Conceptions. I believe that twins often come to the same decisions, perform the same way and make the same choices, but it's not as though they're communicating. Their genes simply predispose them to make these similar choices.
But the special language issue...
That's different. When we talk about special languages, this is more common in twins, but can also occur between same-age unrelated infants who are raised together. And because twins tend to spend a lot of time together and perhaps less language experience with an adult, they often will develop their own verbal expressions or physical gestures, and so this may actually hold back their language development. But this in no way implies any kind of telepathy. You know, if you think about how you may have a best friend and you and the best friend kind of exchange a glance at times, and the whole situation is summed up in that glance, that's what identical twins are so good at in so many domains of behavior.
Have you seen that YouTube video of the twins that I think they're 18 months old? Maybe they're younger than that. And they're just going, blah, 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 at each other and laughing at each other's jokes.
Yeah, Brooke, I show that to my students every semester, and I love it. And to me, that video captures the evolution of the twin bond and the so-called twin language. Those kids are hysterical, and they know what's funny, and yet we don't. But I will tell you that I spoke to a mother once who had an older child and twins, and she said that the older child can often act as a translator, telling her what the twins are up to. And I thought, isn't that interesting? Maybe a linguist could use those older siblings as research assistants to find out what's going on.
So what about the depiction of twins culturally? Identically dressed twin toddlers may delight us. Some twins, like the ones in The Shining, terrify us. There are lots of twins in mythology, twins as gods, evil twins, and so on. Why does the idea of twins so consistently captivate us?
In the arts, in mythology, in movies, in literature, twins are very convenient devices for exploring duality, good and evil, happy and sad. Now, why is the public so enchanted with twins? I think it's because we all grow up believing, and rightfully so, that we're all individuals, that we look different, we behave differently. I think that when we encounter two people who look and act so much alike, it challenges the way we think that the world works. And many of us admire and even envy the intimacy that identical twins convey. They're so accepting of one another, so non-judgmental, and who among us wouldn't want to enjoy a relationship of that kind? So for some people, seeing identical twins might almost seem claustrophobic, too much togetherness. But on the other hand, they're still intrigued by it. So I think that's why we are so captivated.
Which brings us back to that documentary, Three Identical Strangers, for a minute. There is one doctor who had some involvement with the study that the triplets were unwittingly engaged in, and she said this.
We would prefer that we have some influence over our lives. Wouldn't you rather know that you have some control over this? And so finding out, never mind, doesn't matter what you do. So I think it's upsetting to people to see how little influence they have, how little control they have. We don't like that. We fight that.
Genes don't tell us what to do. They may predispose us in certain ways, but ultimately we make the choice to do something. We know that divorce has a genetic component to it, but we can choose to stay with a partner or divorce. We have a lot of control over our lives. It's just that genes may guide us in certain sorts of directions. I think a great example of that is a pair of twins we studied in Minnesota named Jack and Oscar. They were born in 1933. Jack was raised Jewish by his father in Trinidad, and Oscar was raised Catholic in Nazi Germany with his mother. Oscar was in the Hitler Youth, but he was only 12 when the war ended. These two, of course, had very different political and historical understandings, but they both coped with their rearing situations in similar ways. Jack by becoming very pro-British in Trinidad because he didn't want people to know of his German background, and Oscar becoming very pro-German because he didn't want people to know of his Jewish background. And when they met, they spoke to one another and realized that had their positions been reversed, they both would have embraced a point of view that they currently disliked. So The context in which we find ourselves certainly can make a difference, but we can choose or not choose a certain perspective or a certain way of looking at things.
You heard me refer a couple of times to nature versus nurture.
Oh, yeah.
two things, separate and immutable.
Yeah.
That is really reductive, right?
Yes. In fact, I should have probably caught you on that. We never really say nature versus nurture. That's a false dichotomy that was put to rest years ago. What we talk about is nature and nurture, or nature via nurture. Nature via nurture is a nice conceptualization of that, because if you think about how you put your house together or the occupations you have or how your environment is constructed, you see genetic influence on your environment. You know, you choose to put certain paintings on the wall. You choose certain outfits. You choose a certain design of your home. Why do you do that? Because they're pleasing to you in some way. In an individual, nature and nurture are completely intertwined. It cannot be separated. We separate them only statistically in a population, and that can give us a good handle on what somebody's chance of having Alzheimer's or diabetes or something like that might be, but it's not totally deterministic. We know, for example, that autism has a high genetic component. We know that from twin studies, on the order of about 70%. But a given twin pair, if you have one affected child, the other one may be never, ever affected by autism. So you can't generalize from the population to the individual. You can only use it as a very rough guide.
So you have a fraternal twin. Do you ever wish you had an identical one?
You know, I've thought about that sometimes. I'd never want to give up my fraternal twin, but I think more that I wish we were triplets and there was a fraternal and an identical. I think it would be kind of fun. I am fascinated by identical twins and the intimacy that they share and the similarities that they display. So I've often wondered what it would be like, but I'm very happy with my situation as it is.
Sometimes I wish I had an evil twin.
There's no such thing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Nancy Siegel is a professor of psychology at California State University at Fullerton and director of its Twin Studies program, and the author of Accidental Brothers, The Story of Twins Exchanged at Birth, and The Power of Nature and Nurture.
I wish I had an evil twin.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Micah Lowinger, Leah Fetter, and John Hanrahan. We had more help from Asa Chaturvedi and Samantha Maldonado. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Down and down he goes.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. Sometimes.